pancreas transplant. So you now have foreign cells in you, and if you don't take immunosuppressants, your body will attack those insulin-producing cells, and you're back to type 1 diabetes. But I thought it was very fascinating, and hopefully someday they'll be able to coax our own cells back into stem cell stage, and then you won't even need the immunosuppressants. So that's good news. I thought I'd share that with the rest of you.
KD2WOT.
Yes, WOT.
Yeah, good evening. A very interesting topic, Roy. I was wondering, there are people now that when the woman gives birth, where they save, you know, some of the cord blood, would that, you know, be able to produce stem cells somehow?
Yeah, very likely. If they could store it successfully over a long period of time and thaw it out and still be viable, that would be a good opportunity. And you know, that might be the short-term solution. I don't know whether it's cost-effective. I'm sure insurance companies would be very upset if everyone had that done, because they would kind of look at the number of people who would need those stem cells at this point and say it's not financially responsible for them. But yeah, that would be an excellent use for those. I've heard of that. I think most of the stem cells have kind of, that are used for this procedure might have some kind of ethical problem. Sometimes stem cells are taken from fetal cells of miscarriages and or abortions.
But in a case where someone's own, you know, cord blood, should they develop a disease later in life, like type 1 diabetes, you know, potentially, I guess they could be treated with their own stem cells.
Yep, that would be a very good use for it. At this point, we don't know enough to turn stem cells into almost anything else. I think they spent a good 5-6 years trying to figure out how to coax the stem cell into being a pancreatic islet Langerhans insulin-producing cell. It may be that they just lucked out, that they found a particular cell line that's relatively easy to coax from stem cell. Or it may be that you just have to get the right combination right, and there's all kinds of cells that you can turn stem cells into. They have the potential. The only question is, do we have the know-how to coax them in that direction? Well, once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're running to the end of this segment, but if anyone has any questions, topics, or statements, and they'd like to make it in the next 2-3 minutes, this is as good a time as any.
KD2GUU, quick question going back to the coax discussion.
Roy, I just sent you the email with point of charge and line of charge and spherical waves and a cylindrical wave. Thank you.
Okay, Wesley, I'll take a look at it, and maybe we'll save that for next week, because SpaceNet report is any minute now. KD2GUU, what's your first name?
This is Daryl. My name is Daryl, relatively new. And a quick question about the coax. I just ordered some, and I found it a little confusing, the RG8, RG8U, and RG8X, RG58. I found a table that explains attenuation numbers, but I don't know exactly what that meant. Can you give me a quick description of higher versus lower attenuation numbers and how they affect the signal?
Yeah, sure. The way most attenuation charts operate is 100 feet. So in other words, for 100 feet of any given coaxial cable, what is the loss from the insertion point to the place where the signal leaves and goes to the antenna. And it's in decibels. So it'll say something, and it's also frequency dependent. And each coaxial cable is differently designed and has different attenuation losses. Usually bigger, thicker hard wire and such gives you lower attenuation losses. You want as small an attenuation loss as possible. So say you look up something, and at the frequency that you are using it, one coax cable rates the attenuation loss at 3 decibels for 100 feet, and you're running a length of 100 feet into your a shack from your antenna. 3 decibels basically means that you're losing 50% of your signal. So if your transmitter sends out 100 watts, by the time it gets to the antenna, it's now attenuated to 50 watts. Now say you're looking at a cheaper transmission line that has an attenuation loss of 6 dB per 100 feet at that frequency that you're still using. That would mean that the total loss now would be 6 dB, which would be 3/4 of your power would be eaten up by the transmission line. Your 100 watts goes into your transmitter, and you get 25 watts at the antenna. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Thank you. Is there, between RG8, what I saw most of was RG8 U and X. Is one better than the other for a number of frequencies? Like HX. I have an antenna that should be 10 meters to 60 meters. Is one of those coaxes better for that?
Well, I mean, all things being equal, the frequency range of those coaxial cables are fine. The only problem is that as you increase the frequency, as you narrow the diameter usually and get less expensive coax cables, the attenuation loss increases. And also, to a degree, the power handling capacity of thinner coaxial cable is less than thicker. You know, LMR 400 is kind of the semi-standard for low loss, high power usage HF use. RG8 is kind of the non-low loss version. It doesn't have as many bells and whistles. It has the approximately similar characteristics, but whereas LMR 400 is dually shielded, has a couple of other little tricks, RG8 isn't. RG8X is a smaller coaxial cable. It's thinner, so it has a higher attenuation loss, and it has a lower power handling capability.
Thank you. I think I understand perfectly. I appreciate the information.
Well, you're welcome. You know where to find us. Anytime you got a problem, feel free to drop in, Daryl.
Thanks, I will. I've been listening off and on for a little while.
Okay, very good. So we'll table Wesley's topic for next Sunday night. I want to thank everyone once again for participating. That makes or breaks any technical net. You don't want to hear me just do a monologue. I don't want to hear me do a monologue. I'm sure you don't want me. I want to hear me do a monologue. So I just want to remind people, if you want to contact me and email for either mailbag questions or topics of discussion or puzzle questions, then you just direct it at mailbag@ac2gs.com. You want to direct something at Paul. You can tell me and I'll tell him, but you can send it directly to him at spacenetreport@gmail.com. The link page, as always, is roy.ac2gs.com. The audio stream for the Glen Oaks repeater is technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive. He has technical Limark TechNets that go back to September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. He has already over 1 million visitors, so make it 1,000,001. So once again, thanks to everyone. A happy and a healthy new year. And now Paul WS2N will bring you the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS WS2N, thanks, Roy. And very good. Yeah, we'll, this is going to be the last net for this year. So I thought we could do a year in review of what went on here for the last 12 months. We used to do that years ago, but I don't know, last year, forgot what happened. I was unable to do it. And previous year, I think we had interference problems, whatever it was. But anyway, we'll go back to doing this if we can. Of course, the main story, though, for December, of course, was the James Webb Space Telescope, which took off on Christmas morning at 7:20 in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. So I'm up early anyway for Christmas, and sure enough, I put on the NASA TV, and they had the successful launch of James Webb. This thing has been looking to get off the ground as early as 2017. They've been trying to build this for the last like 20 years. They've been thinking about it for 30 years. I remember when they used to call it the Next Generation Telescope. And then they came up with the name, James Webb, and they made it an infrared telescope. We're going to see in that wavelength. They're hoping to look back to the beginning of time, past what Hubble could do. Hubble works in visible light and a little into the infrared and a little bit into the ultraviolet as well. This one is pretty much into the infrared, but it's gonna bring back beautiful pictures. It ran a little over budget. It ran all the way up to $10 billion, so it's the most expensive satellite that's ever been launched. We got involved with the European Space Agency and with Canada, of course NASA, and the European Space Agency offered to be the launch provider for James Webb. Which was a good idea. You know, they had a terrific record with the Ariane 5 rocket. I think they've launched a little over 80 missions so far. All of them were successful. I think they had trouble with one of the earlier ones. So it's a very reliable rocket to launch this 13,000-pound thing all the way to L2. Lagrange Point 2, that's 1 million miles away from the Earth, four times the distance of the Moon, and it will be staring out away from the Earth 100% of the time, but it'll see the whole universe by going around the Sun along with the Earth, you know, once a year. So it'll orbit the Earth, it'll orbit the Sun once a year. It won't orbit the Earth. It'll be looking down at Earth as far as the X-band communications between Webb and Deep Space Network. That'll be the only part looking back toward Earth. They've developed this Mylar type material to unfurl, open up, to be as big as a tennis court. They keep saying that on TV, as big as a tennis court. And on one side, you're going to have high temperatures of, you know, 250 degrees Fahrenheit. And on the other side, you're going to have low cryogenic temperatures, you know, maybe around 40 degrees Kelvin, just, you know, above absolute zero. And then you're going to have an active refrigeration system on board to even bring the temperatures lower, slightly below 7 degrees Kelvin, on, you know, to work with one of the instruments that they have on board. So if all goes well, these pictures will be able to be seen probably about 5 or 6 months from now. James Webb is was launched, went up to escape velocity, which is around, I think, 23,500 miles an hour to get away from the Earth. And now, you know, when the engine shut off, you know, you have on the Ariane 5 rocket, you have two solid booster rockets, and you have the core Vulcan engine that runs on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. When that shuts down, first the two solids separate. You know, it's kind of like the old shuttle system. The two solids separate, then the core keeps firing with the Vulcan engine for another 7 minutes after that. And then that shuts down, that separates, and then there's a second engine, another liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, second stage attached to, that's still attached to the James Webb Space Telescope, and that fires for another, I think, 7 or 8 minutes. So, you know, you have rocket propulsion for almost 30 minutes, I think it was 27 minutes, but after that, second stage separated successfully from the James Webb Space Telescope, and I was talking to Chris K2 SCP before, and we talked about the cameras, and sure enough, they did have one camera. I didn't think they did, but they did have one camera. I got to see the separation of the second stage from James Webb when James Webb was left going all by itself. And the first movements of James Webb, you know, it's all cramped into the fairings. After the fairings are gone, you know, you have the satellite, and then it's flying all by itself. It has to open up. It's all compressed. The first thing that has to open up is the solar panel to start delivering power to the James Webb. It's running a battery uphill. But sure enough, we saw the solar panel actually deploy using the camera that was attached to the top of the second stage of the Ariane 5 rocket. So you actually got to see the deployment of that. And they made a comment that it was supposed to actually open up a little later. But it's all run on computers. It's all autonomous. And it, for some reason, it chose to open up at that time. So you got to see it. Then as it traveled further away from Earth, the next deployment was the high-gain antenna. That successfully opened up and is now pointing toward Earth. And now it's going to go through a series of things that it has to do. You know, it's got a thrusters on board. It's probably one of its thrusters to do a mid-course correction. And then after that, the mission control will start looking at all the telemetry, and they'll start going through step by step of this origami type of system of opening up the James Webb. You know, the main parts are going to start opening, unfurling. The starboard point, the starboard port sides will start doing their jobs as well. You know, first thing they have to do is get the sunshade open up, which is 5 layers of Mylar insulation. That will be the first thing. That's going to take quite a few days. Now you got to remember, this is all still traveling away from Earth, all the way to 4 times the distance away from the Moon. And so for the next 29 days, this is what's going to be going on. The shades will open up. Eventually, the mirrors. It's got a 21 foot diameter mirror. Compare that to Hubble, it's roughly 8 feet. It's got these 18 segmented mirrors. Each one made from beryllium. Beryllium is a metal that really doesn't want to expand or contract under the hot or cold conditions. So they use that as a substrate to these mirrors. They were ground down to near perfection, from what I understand. And then it was coated with gold. They put it into a chamber, and they had the gold gold, like a gold mist cover this thing. That's why it looks gold. Apparently gold is a very good reflecting material for infrared telescopes. So off it goes, and eventually when it, you know, all these different parts open and move, the secondary mirror has to be brought out. That's all folded up. That'll be brought out, put into position. When that's all done, thrusters will fire again to actually get this into its, what they call a halo orbit, out 1 million miles away from Earth. And what that does is it just circles out there all by itself. And it will be, the idea of that is to make sure Earth doesn't actually get in the way. It wants to look at the sun all the time because of the solar panel. And of course, that's going to make it hot on one side, and the other side is going to be really super cold, minus 448 degrees Fahrenheit. And then now the mission control will realign these mirrors once they're in position. They have a little actuators that could move these. Each mirror could be moved in, you know, from a distance of like the thickness of a hair, you know, that at a time. So that what they're going to do is they're going to stab the telescope at the sky, look at one particular star. I guess they'll choose which one at the time. I don't know which one they're going to choose. And then that light will be coming down, and it will be hitting all 18 mirrors at the same time. And they're going to look where those points of light are from that star, and then realign each mirror to make sure that the focus, you know, into the secondary mirror, and then back to the tertiary mirror, the third piece, which brings it into the detectors. They're going to look at that, and once all of those are in the center of each 18 mirrors, then they'll have it, and that will be 100% in focus. But that's going to take a couple of months. They don't expect maybe first light, the actual pictures, you know, start coming in until maybe May. Who knows, maybe June if they have, you know, some problems. So we got, you know, roughly 5 or 6 months to see if all of this is going to work. And that was the James Webb Space Telescope. You can just follow this step by step. NASA has a great site, a website. It's called, go to web.nasa.gov. That's web, W-E-B-B, so there's two B's involved. It's James Webb, his name was spelled W-E-B-B. So it's web.nasa.gov, web.nasa.gov. You go there and you get all kinds of information. But I like the one where, it says, you know, where is James Webb at the time you click on that, and it's got this timeline, you know, from the launch all the way until, you know, when it gets to the L2 location, Lagrange Point 2, and all the steps in between, you know, you'll see there, then they have numbers coming up, and they'll say how many miles per second is it going. You know, after launch, I think it got up to, 7 miles per second or something, which was like at 23,000 miles per hour. Already, it's already slowed down to, it's in the point numbers, like 0.8 something, 0.89 miles per second. And if you convert that, you're into like 3,500 miles an hour. That's now how fast it is going away from Earth. So it started off fast, just, you know, 23,000 miles an hour, and now you're already down to, you know, almost 3,000 miles an hour. And that continues to slow a little bit as time goes on. And the idea is eventually it'll slow down to, like, practically nothing, because once it gets to that halo location, that will be it. You won't see it going any further away from Earth. It'll be staying at a certain number, probably 1 million miles away from Earth. So it's got that information on there, and then also you could click on explore the deployment. So all the things I was mentioning now, you know, the first thing that opened up was the solar panel, then the antenna, and the sunshades. Another segment where the whole telescope rises away from the base of the spacecraft. You know, it has the deployment of the, you know, the mirrors, how they're going to fold into place. You can see each thing. You could actually click on each one individually, and it gives you a real close-up view of how this is all going to work. It's pretty interesting. You know, they'll give you information, you know, throughout the mission at that particular site, web.nasa.gov. Any questions or comments before I do this year in review? You know, this took care of December, that's for sure. Okay, we don't have to wait for EchoLink. I mean, IRLC, I guess. That's all under construction. But anyway, you know, back in January, we first started talking about the Arecibo antenna, the possibility of that thing being rebuilt. That thing was hit by a Category 4 hurricane, Hurricane Marie, back in September of last year. But January, we were talking about the possibility of Arecibo being built. There is money involved. People want to do that. It might be different than what was there. It might be a series of multiple antennas all put down and then you know connected with interferometry between them all to make it look like it's looking at one location. We'll see. But that's what we started with. And the following week, we were talking about Cygnus coming back. Cygnus. 14 mission by Cygnus, built by Northrop Grumman, launched on an Antares rocket from Wallops Island, not too far from Long Island, 200 miles from here. And they bring up cargo to the space station, just like the Dragon brings up cargo. Cygnus brings it up. Each time it goes up, it looks like it keeps bringing up heavier and heavier material. I think they're up to around 8,000 pounds or so. So, that was pretty good, and that one was named after Kalpana Chawla. She was one of the people that were killed on Columbia, unfortunately. And she was a ham, by the way. KD-5 ESI, as well as two other hams. There were seven people that died on Columbia. Space shuttle, but out of the seven people, three of them were hams, and Northrop Grumman honored her by naming that Cygnus spacecraft after her. Anyway, as the weeks went on, Virgin Orbiter, that's a spinoff from Virgin Galactic, the Richard Branson Company, successfully launched one of their rockets into orbit. And that's the one that they dropped from the 747. It's got a 747 with this liquid fuel rocket engine. I think it's a four-stage rocket. Anyway, he drops it from the 747 around 7 or 8 miles high, and then it ignites. He tried a couple of times to get it into orbit. And this time he did that back in this past January. On board was a couple of satellites, and seven satellites, one of which was an amateur radio satellite, which had a transponder on it, and had an uplink, you know, of on 2 meters, you know, 145.860, and then it had a downlink on 70 centimeters, which was 435.460 through 435.790. So yeah, that was interesting. I think they had problems getting that thing working though. if they ever did. But the satellites went into orbit, so that was their first successful launch. They've made other ones since that time. So that's a Virgin Orbital spin-off of Virgin Galactic, the one that makes the plane that's sending people into space, which happened later this year. Let me drop it. I mentioned the Cargo Dragon. Yeah, they had their 21st one returning from the space station as well last January. And this is their newer version, number 20 and 21 that SpaceX makes, the cargo version. They used to have the big solar panels that opened up. It's done away with that. Now that solar panels are covering the body or what they call the trunk, the back part of the spacecraft, so they've done away with the motorized opening solar panels. That makes things easier. They also changed the docking system. They no longer berth to the International Space Station with only 16 bolts, that motorized bolts that they were using. They don't need the robotic arm that's attached to the space station to grab it and put it attached to the to one of those berthing ports. Now it comes in autonomously, just like the ones that carry people. And it'll come in and fly in with this different system. And it pulls itself in, does a soft dock and then a hard dock after that. And it's a quick operation. It doesn't take long, like the berthing system. And then you can open up the hatch, and they bring in all the cargo. And it also has a trunk, which brings up different pieces of equipment that could eventually be installed to the outside of the International Space Station. They have the big stuff in the trunk, so the robotic arm, after it's attached, will come along and take stuff out of the back of the Dragon to install on the space station. That's pretty good. Another thing that Elon Musk did, he's watching all of this, but he must be getting bored with the Falcon 9. He really wants to build a starship. So he's getting ready to not only launch from the shore of Texas, or from Florida, which he plans on doing as well. But he bought two gigantic oil rigs that were not being used anymore. These are massive things, you know. It's like building, it's like a skyscraper in the ocean, you know. They're floating platforms, and he can bring them out to the Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico. And eventually he could launch or maybe even land starships on this thing. So he put two things, and he put them under construction. They're not in operation, of course, yet, but he's got plans further down the road, so I guess he thinks ahead. So, let me drop it and see if there's any comments or questions. WS2. Okay, I'll try to move it along here. Anyway, in February, China wound up launching a spacecraft to Mars. It consisted of three parts, an orbiter, a lander, and a rover. They launched, actually last year, in the summertime, and it arrived at Mars, and then went into orbit, and eventually it separated from the mothership. The orbital one is still taking pictures and doing stuff in orbit, and China landed the Jiurong lander. The rover, Jiurong rover, had the lander, and then the rover drove away from the lander, and it's still operating today. That's the solar panel system. That was successful, and at one point, I believe a ham radio operator from British Columbia heard the signal of coming back from that orbiter around Mars. They wrote that up in the ARRL newsletter. Okay, one of the spacewalks that was done early, I think it was either late January or early February, you had two ham radio operators actually went out to do that. Kate Rubens, KG5, GYJ, and Victor Glover, KI5, BKL. They did a somewhat successful EVA. They didn't complete everything that they wanted to do, but they attached all these brackets and things for the ROSA system, the rollout solar array system that the International Space Station is getting an upgrade on their solar panels. You know, even so, they got 165,000 watts. This will be we'll be able to upgrade them to around 210, I think, kilowatts power once it's completely done. And it doesn't fold out like an accordion. These things roll out. They're called rollout solar arrays. They were brought up in the trunk, like I mentioned earlier, with the Dragon. And then the robotic arm takes it out and hands it off to spacewalkers, and eventually they install them. So hopefully that all goes well. They've done one complete setup, and the year, next year goes by, and the following year, they'll complete that eventually by doing the other solar panels as well to supplement their power. They degrade over time out in space, it's hard to believe, but they do degrade. Not only that, they've added a lot of extra modules and more experiments than they thought they would ever have, which eats up a lot of power. Also, any of the spacecraft that attaches to it, the cargo version or the manned vehicles, you know, Soyuz or Dragon, or eventually Starliner by Boeing, you know, they hook up to the solar panel for the months on end, sometimes over 200 days that they're attached, and then they run heaters and all kinds of equipment in the spacecraft. You know, they don't use the spacecraft power; they tap it off the space station. So all that extra power is needed, and you know, not to be outdone during that month of March, Starship did start flying. They're running tests. Starship is being built by Elon Musk, you know, SpaceX, and their goal is to eventually go to Mars. Looks like they're going to have a detour, eventually land on a moon. Presently, NASA's got one of these Starships for doing just that. But anyway, you have to get them off the ground, so he started flying these things this year. And a couple of them crashed pretty dramatically. You know, it was launched from Texas, from Boca Chica, Texas. It's got this whole, like, small city being built called the Star Base. You know, Star Base, he launches these rockets, and they went up a short distance, and it came down, blew up. Then he launched around 10,000 feet. Done it a couple of times, and then they tilt over and they come down. They've got these, like, little wings that are attached to it that move around, and they guard themselves back to where they want, you know, took off from. And these nitrogen rockets that fire, that flip the thing you know, back upright at the last second. At the same time, the three engines, he's using three engines right now for the Starship Ignite. They're called Raptor engines, and they're twice as powerful as the engines that you would normally put on the Falcon 9. And the engines fire, it comes down, it looks like it's going to land a couple of times. One time it did land, stayed there for about 30 seconds to a minute, and then tilted over and blew up. And it wasn't until, I guess, his fifth or I guess around the fifth one, the fifth try, that he successfully landed one, and that was that he stopped testing. So that's the story with the Starship, and that started back in March. So let me drop it for any comments. WS2N. Okay, the International Space Station is still making good use of the Kaibo airlock system. They're pushing satellites out of there every now and then. Some of them are amateur satellites. Most of them are science satellites. But they have an airlock that they, you know, small, relatively small, small one. You can put like maybe the size of a microwave into it and eventually push them out. They have a small robotic arm that they use, and they deploy them into orbit. You know, they're brought up by the cargo vehicles, and that's still going on. But one of the flights brought something up called the Bishop, built by Nanoracks, and attached Bishop to one of the large birthing pieces located on one of the modules called Tranquility. This way, now they have a large one. You can take something as big as a refrigerator and put it into space, or even bring it in from space, which they've never had. Now they have that capability. That was brought up by a Dragon cargo vehicle. Like I mentioned before, they bring up this big stuff in the trunk of Dragon. So now you have had crews in the beginning of the year. You know, they had a regular crew of six. Now that's been extended to seven because you have regular flights by SpaceX bringing up four people at a time. So you have four people from SpaceX, and you have always three people from Russia, and the Soyuz vehicle. But now you have a regular crew of seven, starting in with longer crew missions. They've taken this one guy that went up, Mark Vanderheil. He's been up before. Also a ham, KG5GNP, now expected to stay here, not for 6 months, which they normally stay, but he's going to be up there for almost a whole year. And they've done this before, when I say they, NASA and Russia. Christine Cook, she did it. She spent almost a whole year up there. Before that, it was Scott Kelly. He did the same thing as well. So they're getting ready for longer and longer missions because that's what they're going to have to do. If they plan on eventually going to Mars, it's going to be roughly a six-month trip there, another six-month trip back, maybe a year on the planet itself. You know, they've got to be able to endure space for extremely long periods of time and try to stay healthy at the same time. So, now during this period, this March-April period, ham shack in Columbia broke. It wasn't working, and they think it was due to one of the EVAs that they were doing. Apparently one of the cables weren't, the new cables that they were using wasn't really proper. They tried to use that multitasking, doing other work for the Columbia module. Anyway, over the time from March to April, eventually they got it working. They did another EVA, and they put that on the list on fixing that cable, putting a different cable in. Anyway, the ham shack is back to operation. Let me drop it. Toward the end of March, another company that's going to be launching rockets probably within another year or so. This company, they call themselves Launcher, of all things. And Launcher is, you know, they need a better name. But anyway, they come out of Brooklyn, New York. And this fella that runs it, he realized he needs a bigger place, so he's moving to the same location where SpaceX is located, in Hawthorne, California. So he's moving his company. I guess any of the workers that were working for him there. This fellow, Max Holt, I think he's from the Netherlands, but he's been in the States for a long time. And he's developed this company. He ran some rocket tests, the engine tests, out in Calverton, out here in Suffolk County. which was successful. He built these 3D engines, like 100% 3D engines. You know, some of the ones that are made nowadays are 3D also, but not all of them are 100%. And this guy is going full blast. So hopefully he'll get a rocket off the ground and he'll be located in California. And I don't know where he plans on launching from. It might be Vandenberg. Maybe it'll be Kodiak Launch Complex in Alaska. I don't know. But anyway, we wish him luck. He comes out of Brooklyn, New York. Okay. Also, in April, you had Rocket Lab launching more rockets. They launched another one that eventually they start collecting their boosters as they're coming down. They're coming down on parachutes now. So they were all following Elon Musk's idea of reusability. Eventually, they'll take some of these boosters that are coming down on the rocket called Electron, and made by Rocket Lab, and they'll start reusing them. And we'll see what happens. Also in April, unfortunately, the InSight mission is they were doing an experiment with InSight is located on Mars. They were doing an experiment with this mole that was supposed to be hammering itself into the surface. After 2 years of trying and trying this and trying that, it just wouldn't go straight down. And it wouldn't, either underpowered or they hit a rock. They don't know. It's just not working out. And the idea was to go about 15 feet into the ground to get measurements under the ground, temperature measurements under the ground. But the other part of InSight worked great, which is the seismometer. They had a robotic arm put a seismometer on the surface of Mars, and that thing is still working good. But the heat probe system with this mole that was supposed to hammer itself into the surface just didn't work out. But in February, February 18th, Perseverance landed on Mars. And that's this massive rover, as big as Curiosity. It's like the size of a car. It weighs 2,000 pounds, over 2,000 pounds here on Earth. It weighs one-third of that on Mars. And it has a helicopter called Ingenuity. Ingenuity successfully deployed from Perseverance and has flown. They were hoping it would fly maybe five times. It keeps flying. They put it into an operational mode instead of just test. They're flying ahead, looking ahead where Perseverance will be driving. Anyway, it's now flown 17 times. I think I might have missed one. I think it's now up to 18 different times that Ingenuity has flown on Mars. Terrific helicopter. It's got these 4 foot long blades. It just works great. During that month, also, China launched their first part of their space station. There's now a crew of three riding around in another space station that China has built. So and we have competitions, but they still have ways to catch us. They have now a rover riding on the moon, a rover riding around on Mars, and three people flying around in their space
complete
station, which they plan on making bigger and bigger. Also in April, Strato launch, the world's largest plane, got off the ground. That thing is, the wingspan is larger than any other plane. It's longer than a football field, so it's like, over 100 yards. And the idea of this plane was in the beginning was to launch not only rockets in space by dropping it and doing that. Strato launcher was going to eventually launch people in space, maybe two or three people in the Dream Chaser. But as time went on, they kind of got canceled that. I thought maybe they gave up with this thing, but now it's been flying again. I think the military wants to use it to test their hypersonic vehicles, these hypersonic vehicles that will be able to carry warheads. And it looks like they're going to use this thing as a test bed, massive plane. It's got six Rolls Royce, you know, 747 engine, you know, instead of a 747 having, you know, like four engines, this thing's got six, and it could carry a tremendous payload up into the atmosphere, and then drop it from this dual fuselage plane, straddle launch. It's pretty good. Anyway, we'll try to wrap this up. But, we only made it up to, May, so I'm into May. Maybe we could finish the rest of it next week, getting to 11 o'clock. I don't want to overdo it, but yeah, we've gone through half the year anyway, and we'll finish the other half next year. We'll start in June, I guess. We don't have all that much. I covered the main topics. A lot of the future topics that we'll have to do with the manned space program, the commercial space program, one right after the other. Virgin Galactic successfully launched people into suborbital space. You have Blue Origin, three missions, three flights into suborbital flight. First two missions carried four people each. Now this last one that just went last during this month is was six people. So included in the flight with four people was William Shatner, you know, from Star Trek, 90 years old. He went up. He loved it. We'd go up again. Let me drop it. So really, that's during that next couple of months, that's what they'll be. We'll be talking about anyway. I think that you know, a couple of things like the China sending back pictures from Mars. You know, they left a camera out on Mars to take a selfie of itself driving around on Mars. So, you know, you have things like that. I think that's pretty much it. We probably won't cover the other stories. You know, the one main story was a near disaster with the Nauka module being attached from Russia to the space station. It's a big, massive module, and they attached it. Now, this would have been like a November story, so they attached the module, and the thrusters started firing for no reason. The computer on board thought it wanted to back away from the space station, so it's firing its thrusters, and it flipped this whole thing. It's like a 30-story building, you know, the International Space Station. It is massive. And it flipped the whole thing, you know, slowly, but it flipped it one and a half turns completely before they got it under control and was able to. I think what happened there was the fuel ran out on those thrusters. But anyway, they fixed that problem. So that would have been another story. But of course, it finished up with a great story. Like I started in the beginning with the James Webb Space Telescope, and if you go to that website, you get a lot of information on what this thing is. This was Dick's favorite thing. I wish he was alive to see this launch. You know, Dick K2RIW, he started this this net decades ago. His goal was to see James Webb Space Telescope launch and then do like an A-B test with Hubble. You know, you have was hoping Hubble would still be operating, and it is today. They had some problems recently, but they got it up working. Point the two of them in the sky at the same time and take an A-B picture and compare the two. I hope they do that someday. That was one of K2RAW's wish. We're going to turn it over to you, Roy, until we are grinding halt. You know, I went on and on, and I hope everybody enjoyed this year. Have a good, happy new year next year. And back to you, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
This is AC2GS. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for Limark the Club. Everyone appreciates it. I certainly do. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight and everyone who's participated through 2021. It's been a good year in some ways, a terrible year in others. But when it comes to this club and this net, nothing but good things to say. So I hope that you'll return and join me on the journey in 2022 when we do this all over again next Sunday night. As Dick often ended his technical nets, be kind to each other. That's especially important these days. Be smart, be safe, get your vaccinations, get your boosters, socially distance, all the right things that you know are right. And we'll get through all this together. So thanks again. Have a happy and a very healthy new year. Be well. And we'll talk again. This is AC2GS formally closing the post-Christmas, pre-New Year edition of the Limar Technical Net. And this is AC2GS going clear. Until next time, guys.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Here's N2DQI for your N2DQI listening.
times as